Good morning. Happy Wednesday. Welcome to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you as always. And joining in studio today for the first hour of the show, Madison Shipman is with us. Madison, good morning.
Good morning. How are you guys doing?
Doing well. This is every time Dan Schulman's on the schedule, we're like, oh, God, they're going to lose. It's going to be a negative show. And then we get a double homer walk-off with you coming on. Perfect timing.
Yeah, I will say I was really excited that they were able to hit those walk-offs because I was here for the Phillies series, which did not exactly go that same direction. So I was starting to think maybe it was me, but they turned things around. So I appreciate that.
It's interesting. There are a lot of theories as to what is causing the Blue Jays' streakiness over the last couple of years. You have pointed out that you think you have a bad record.
Yes, yes.
Ben Schulman has a very bad record when he shifts over to TV.
Eric Smith, I think, by trickle down, just called his first win of the season yesterday.
When Ben Schulman moves to TV, Eric Smith fills in on radio.
Yeah.
And it also has a bad record. So I don't know who we blame. Do we blame Madison? We're not blaming Madison. She's on the show with us. If Ben or Eric want to come on the show with us in studio for an hour, they can save themselves some blame.
Well, Eric and I did call a radio series together last year, and it was actually against the Diamondbacks.
Okay.
And I'm pretty sure they didn't win any of those games either. Yeah. I will have to go back and look. But so when we're in the radio booth together, the record is not great.
Yeah, the double negative turns out it's not a positive. Whatever your math teacher taught you in high school is incorrect. Double negative is just super bad negative. But it's very positive to have you here with us for this one. And you're going to do some radio games later in the season as well, right?
Yes.
In addition to Blue Jay Central.
Yeah, so hopefully I turn my record around in the radio booth a little bit later this year.
Yeah, we'll do that. Before we get into the back-to-back home runs that the Blue Jays walked off the Arizona Diamondbacks with yesterday, a couple procedural notes. And the first is, speaking of Sportsnet people and personalities, a happy birthday to Chris Black, producer at Sportsnet,
king
of the threads on at Down to Black. Also Caleb Joseph's birthday. Right. So he is not listening to this. Chris Black probably is. Caleb Joseph is at home and definitely not listening to this. But on the odd chance he is, happy birthday to him as well. What a night in baseball for the Blue Jays. Not only did they walk this one off and pull it from the jaws of defeat, but the Yankees, Red Sox, Rays, Twins all lost. The Yankees haven't scored a run in like a month. The Blue Jays...
Stop it.
After a weekend of missed opportunities, made a game on just about everyone yesterday. Didn't look like that for a while. And then, I guess let's just start there. Madison, you're on the desk for Blue Jay Central. Julia, you're in rewrite mode again.
We don't have to talk about it.
You don't want to talk about how you already had your story filed and you had to write a whole new one because of Addison Barger and Bo Bichette?
I don't know how Keegan Mathison knows, but the Blue Jays have had 5 walk-offs this year. I was there with a main bar either ready to go or already filed for 3 of them. So, you know, if I'm in a bit of a weird mood this segment or this first hour of the show until I actually wake up, that's probably why. Madison, let's hear about your experience, which was way more positive.
Well, first, the Vladdy home run was awesome.
Yeah.
And I literally leaned over the side of the set because, I mean, like, to get the ball up into that area, it has to be a really good shot. And when I saw it off of the bat, I'm like, this thing might make it all the way up to the studio set. So I leaned over to see if I could grab it. It was a little bit to our right, but still, it just felt like in that swing, all of a sudden, momentum started to turn a little bit. And then those at-bats in the ninth inning with two strike splitters that end up leaving the yard. I just thought it was one of those games where some little things didn't necessarily go the Blue Jays' way earlier on, but they just kept going at it and finding a way to stay in the game enough to give their offense a chance late in the ball game. And then all of a sudden you had 2 big swings and completely different outcome than I think any of us thought was going to happen in that ninth inning.
Because the at-bats were actually, you know, they were good throughout. And I know that we've been talking a lot about bad luck for this team, but when you look at, you know, an inning where every single ball was put in play over 100 miles per hour and the Blue Jays come away with just 1 run and, you know, there's a .930 expected batting average for one of David Schneider's lineups there.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, you can kind of see that the process is working. I guess it's just rewarding to, you know, actually come out with a win when you're swinging the bat as well as the Blue Jays were yesterday.
Yeah, and I think back to the Philly series, too. Really, outside of the game against Ranger Suarez, like in game one, I felt like the at-bats against Christopher Sanchez were really good, and even some of the at-bats against Zach Wheeler were really good. Those are just really good starting pitchers, so you're not always going to go out there and bat 400 against those guys. But it can be difficult from the hitter's perspective to stick with the process when you're not getting the results. And that's at times where you can start to chase those results, start to chase hits, and then you get out of your swing and your rhythm and your process and all those types of things. So for them to be able to stick to it throughout that game, and Brandon Pfaadt ended up coming out and throwing a lot better than what he has done in his past couple of starts. And I believe it was just two starts ago that he didn't even record an out mm-hmm. in the ball game. So for him to come out and throw a lot better, he was throwing a lot more of those fastballs, and they had to adjust to it and stuck in the game and were able to come away with that win late in the ball game. But the two strike swings too, like to be able to sell out to those pitches and to read them out of the hand and to have a game plan going into those at-bats and drive them out of the ballpark, like that's something special.
Yeah, the Brandon Pfaadt note is interesting, a little bit better than we've seen from him. Stop hitting everyone, though. Three hit by pitch, Jonathan Classe leaves hurt, and then Miles Straw, not hit by a pitch, but leaves hurt. Don't love a five hit by pitch game overall. But you mentioned the two strike swings on those two home runs, so let's dig in on them a little bit. Bo Bichette and Addison Barger both get two strike splitters from Shelby Miller. Now, Shelby Miller is having a nice season. He's having a nice career resurgence for like the fourth time. It feels like he's been down and out so many times in his career. But he's not Justin Martinez. He's not AJ Puck. He's not what they thought Kevin Ginkle would be coming into the season. So, you know, maybe not entirely used to this. This is the first season where he's been a regular closer. And maybe a little guilty of being predictable there. Addison Barger mentioned after the game that he knew what to look for late in the count. And I went and dug up the numbers. And you certainly do know what to look for from Shelby Miller late in the count. So when he is ahead in the count in general, he throws that splitter about 43% of the time. When he has two strikes on a guy, he throws it almost 50% of the time. So you have a pretty good idea that that splitter is coming. Madison, when you hear that, what do you make of, you know, if for Bo too, because he got a splitter in the zone, and Miller obviously didn't execute those. Those are supposed to drop below the zone. But for a hitter as young as Barger, who is a, you know, good process, but big, loud swing guy, to go up there in that big a spot and have the sense of game plan of, I know this is what, if I get behind, this is what I'm looking for, and jumps all over it.
Yeah, with both of those at-bats, what stands out to me is the willingness to fail in those moments. And I know that, you know, it kind of sounds counterintuitive, right? But you have to be willing to take a chance, especially when you have all the data, you have all the statistics that are working in your favor. And to be able to go up there and say, you know what, I know 50-50 shot pretty much what he's going to throw on a two-strike count. And given the way that Barger had swung off of the splitter earlier in the at-bat, you're probably thinking the game plan is to go back to that splitter because he was way out in front of it. And so you're sitting there going, okay, I'm going to use this to my advantage. The information that I have before the at-bat, the information on the swing that I took prior to this last pitch, this two-strike pitch, and I'm going to take a chance and I'm going to sell out for it. And I think, too, what helps Barger in that moment is Bo Bichette getting the home run right before that, because now all of a sudden it's a tie ball game, so the pressure is off just a little bit. So from a hitter's perspective, you can take some of those chances, but that's what I can really appreciate with both of those swings, is it wasn't one of those swings where you're way out in front, your hands are staying back, and you're just doing whatever you can to put the ball in play. Those were home run type of swings. And his reaction afterwards, too, you're seeing it here. Love that he knows it straight off of the bat. I mean, that thing looked like it was going to go about 500 feet. But he does not get cheated on any swing, I can tell you that.
So, yeah, it's great. It's awesome to see. And it's good that you mentioned he swung and missed and chased pretty badly at the 0-0 splitter.
Yes, yeah.
Because the other thing that crossed my mind is when Bo hit one out, is like off a splitter as well that Miller didn't execute that well. I was like, well, maybe he won't go back to it. Maybe he just like doesn't have the feel for it today, but then Barger swings and misses. And you're like, okay, he's probably feeling pretty good about it.
Yeah, well, and that one earlier in the bat too, if I'm remembering correctly, had a bit more of the arm side run to it. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of going away from the lefty barrel. So you're thinking maybe I can get him a bit more out in front with the way that that pitch was moving. But that splitter had a lot more vertical depth and not as much horizontal run to it. So, which plays perfectly into Barger's game plan. But those are the things in the swings, and you can just tell the confidence too. And for the team to stay in that game and the amount of comeback wins that they've had this year, they've been there before. And it does give you a certain level of confidence when you get late into the game and you're thinking, all right, we're still in this one. We've got a chance. If we get a couple of good hits here, then we're back in the ball game. And you see that from this offense. Plus, too, Barger just getting moved into the two spot yesterday. And that worked out about as perfectly as any manager could ever imagine with him coming up with the walk-off home run. So
Do you want the real like sports talk radio caller take on that one? They took moving Vlad down to third in the order took the bat out of his hands in a big spot. He didn't get that extra plate appearance against a leverage reliever at the end of the game.
I mean, yeah, there were questions about that post game, right? You look at the end of the eighth inning, and Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is slated to bat fourth in the bottom of the ninth, and it's like, well, this is why the Blue Jays have been kind of adamant about keeping him in the number two spot. But I'm also wondering, you know, from Barger's perspective there with one out in that moment, the game already tied, as you said, if there is a little bit of just like a even less pressure on his shoulders because he knows that no matter what happens, Vladdy will also get his chance in that moment. And so he can take a bit of a bigger chance there.
Yeah, I agree. And that's where it's all comes down to the situation, right? And like you said, there's just one out and you know that Vladdy's going to be able to come up after that. But that's a product of lengthening out the lineup too, is you're taking pressure off of different guys in the lineup. And you've seen different parts of the lineup produce even over the past couple of weeks. And just those things, whether it's the bottom half of the order being able to get on base and set the table for the top half of the order, and what they've been able to do in two out situations over the past couple of weeks too, I think it's all a product of this lineup working together. And it goes back to executing the game plan. And that doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get the results every single time, but maybe you're wearing down a pitcher, or maybe you're seeing a certain number of pitches to get to a certain arm in the bullpen. All of those things are a product of a good process, good game plan, to where you can set yourself up to give your team a chance to win those ball games late.
The other side of the good game plan is that, again, Shelby Miller trusts his splitter, but you look, the Blue Jays lead the league in homers off off-speed pitches, and it's not particularly close. They do way better. Addison Barger hits off-speed stuff way better than he does certainly breaking balls, where we've seen the breaking ball usage go up. Now, Shelby Miller doesn't have a breaking ball he throws to lefties, so what are you going to do in that case? And then it should be said, Barger also had a laser of a double earlier in the game. Off fought. Kind of, you talk about coming away from the barrel with the splitter, that sinker that just kind of right in the bath path when you're throwing it righty to lefty.
Yeah, I think there was one at bat too. See, I've got my scorebook here with me. I've always
so nicely color coded.
Yeah, I know, right? I try to keep it with me. But there was, he ended up striking out on a curveball in that third inning, and that was an at bat because he ended up hitting that double off of the sinker in the first at bat. Mm-hmm. So I thought, oh, this is a perfect time to go up there and sit on a breaking ball, because the pitcher's thinking, you just smoked the sinker, I got to throw you something else. And maybe it's not the first pitch, but you're probably going to see one of those within the at-bat, and he ended up striking out on a curveball. But those are the types of at-bats where you're thinking, hey, maybe I take a chance here, and it might be a low percentage pitch, but given what you've done in the prior at-bat, maybe that percentage goes up just a little bit more. But ultimately, he ends up taking a chance in that ninth inning and wins the game for the Blue Jays.
Yeah,
so you'll take it.
So Bo Bichette also had an interesting ebb and flow in his game as well. And I know it's something that you mentioned briefly on Blue Jay Central, but probably a nice exhale there when he gets that home run. He jumped all over that splitter as well. What did you see from Bo's game throughout? There was the bases loaded flyout. There was the tough pick on the Barger potential assist. I know you had mentioned on Blue Jay Central that it was kind of a build up to that moment for Bichette.
I think you just saw brief moments of, I don't, frustration might be a little bit of a strong word, but moments where you're thinking like, oh, I needed to execute there. And the bases loaded situation, he went after a sweeper 1-0 count. And you could just tell, like, maybe if that's what he's looking for there, he's still a little bit early on that pitch. And with the bases loaded, two outs, like that's a spot where you want Bo Bichette up in that situation. And then he's just not able to come through right there. But then there was that play at second base, Addison Barger off the wall, Corbin Carroll, who flies around the bases, right? Absolutely flies. And he ends up throwing it into second base, and the throw definitely beat him there. but he wasn't able to pick it out of the dirt, and his immediate reaction was just like, oh.
How tough a pick is that? So you played shortstop.
Yeah, it's tough.
That's coming in 94, and it's a short hop.
Well, and that's and it almost kind of got a little bit mid-hop, too. And so those ones are tough because you have to stand your ground because you've got to apply the tag. But also your glove is moving up, and so you've got to get it and come back down. So it's the timing of getting there as quickly as possible but bringing your glove down as quickly as possible. And sometimes if you bring that glove down too quick, then you miss the ball. And so those are the little things that that add up over the course of the game. But a lot of props to Bo for not letting those moments frustrate him too much to the point where it's spilling over into his other at-bats, because he came through in, up until that point, up until the Barger swing, the biggest moment of the ball game in a two-strike count, and he smokes that splitter out of the ball or out of the ballpark to give them a chance. So just those things too, and like, errors are going to happen. Mistakes are going to happen. You're going to swing at the wrong pitch. You're not going to be on time. But how do you respond? How do you adjust throughout the game and still be able to be productive and come through for the team? And to me, that was exactly what you saw from Bo last night.
Well, we'll talk a bit more about just, you know, how much the Blue Jays need the top of this lineup to actually get going here.
Hey, they heard a 7 hits and 5 indeed. RBI last night from the indeed. Top 3 spots.
Yeah, and we'll also talk about Vladdy in the 3 hole a little bit more, Madison, but as you're talking about, you know, not getting too frustrated with making mistakes and with maybe not swinging at the right pitch or swinging at the wrong pitch or whatever it may be, when you look at a strikeout from Barger like you just laid out for us, is that maybe the product of a little bit of youth, perhaps, and you can see him, or have you seen him so far make those adjustments?
Yeah, I think at times there are pitches that you're going to get beat on too, and maybe you go up there with a certain game plan and the pitcher just doesn't throw it, and then all of a sudden you're finding yourself in a 0-2, 1-2 hole, and you're like, well, all right, here we go. I got to fight my way out of this one. So sometimes that stuff happens, but like I said, it's the response and not letting the at-bat spill over into the other at-bat. You don't want to be taking, you know, the entire season's worth of at-bats with you up there, especially in a moment where the game's on the line. And so I think that's where you continue to see improvement from him. And his swings, he's going to swing hard. And he is going to go all out every single swing. There is no, like, hope, you know, this one just bloops out into the outfield. Like, he's going to crush the ball into the 500 level every single time. So how can you not necessarily rein that in, but control it to the point where he can get to a variety of different pitches? And I think that's where you continue to see him improve, is not just being able to turn on pitches on the inner half, but adjusting to splitters, taking chances and two strike counts. Those are the little things that all of a sudden now you're able to execute it. You're able to just annihilate it. And then you're thinking, all right, now the confidence starts to roll. With his at-bats.
Yeah, annihilate indeed for both of those guys.
So, there are not enough words to describe how hard he is.
So, little trivia for you. This is a week of trivia, apparently, Julia.
Oh,
so,
man,
five times in franchise history now, the Blue Jays have done back-to-back home runs to walk a game off. So, Bo Bichette and Addison Barger last night. Addison Barger did it with someone else in August last year. And he...
I feel like I know the answer to this one, so...
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, do you want me?
Yeah.
Joey Loperfido?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Then we go back. I'm just going to give the 2017 and 2018
that
ones.
That might be the only trivia question I've ever gotten right in my
really?
Whole life. So,
nice.
Yeah.
So Barger and Loperfido did it in August. In 2018, Lourdes Gurriel Jr. and Justin Smoke did it. In 2017, Justin Smoke and Kendry Morales did it. And then in 1985, Cliff Johnson and this Blue Jay did it. And this Blue Jay did it in pinch hit fashion. Any guesses?
I have the doc in front of me, so...
I guess this is the...
I feel like I cheated on my answer, too, because I'm pretty sure Jamie Campbell mentioned it on our
That's
post-game
okay.
show.
Oh. So, do you know the 1985 one, though?
No, I don't know the 1985 one. No,
in 1985,
no.
Cliff Johnson hits a home run to tie it, and then as a pinch hitter to walk it off, Buck Martinez.
Oh, there we go. Man. Love that.
Yeah.
That's
very,
awesome.
Very, very fun one. Okay, so that's Barger and Bo Bichette. The other part of the top of the order, another guy who had a very good game, was Vladimir Guerrero Jr., Now, there is, I'm asking this at least partially tongue-in-cheek, because I don't, you know, there have been guys over the history of baseball who hit a little better in the 3 spot or the 4 spot or the 2 spot or whatever. And there's not a great explanation other than, like, I don't know, I kind of like it. and, like, you only hit third the first time through the batting order.
Yeah.
Vladimir Guerrero Jr. is now at a 915 OPS for his career when he hits third. He is 774 when he hits second, 738 when he hits fourth. So a pretty significant gap there. I don't really know what there's not a good, like, I dug into some of the underlying stuff. Yeah. There's no good reason why.
Yeah. The question here is, what's that about?
Yes. Right? So in your experience, and not every player is the same, obviously, yeah. but does it make much of a difference other than in that first inning?
No, I don't think so. Like, in my opinion, speaking for myself throughout my career, there were times where I batted in the 3 spot, batted in the 4 spot, batted second. The only time that, to me, it was a little bit different was when I was batting leadoff. And now I'm okay giving away my scouting report now because I'm, you know, very much retired. But
well, you never know.
When I was batting second, the batter who was batting leadoff at the time, her name was Megan Gear at Tennessee. She would let me know what the first pitch of the game was because I figured pitchers want to throw their best pitch first pitch of the game. They want to get ahead of the batter. And so then I would use that as the pitch that I would go after in my at bat. So if I'm batting leadoff, then I can't necessarily do that. So I have to come up with a game plan before I step into the batter's box. So to me, the being the leadoff batter is just a little bit different. But other than that, things never necessarily felt all that different, at least for me personally. So when I think about those numbers and how Vladdy's hitting better in the 3 spot, I don't know if there's necessarily a reason for that or if it's just coincidence or maybe he just likes batting in 3 spot.
So what is particularly fascinating about this to me is, again, I said I dug in on the numbers.
Right.
In the first inning specifically, he's not better in the 3 spot. It's only later in the game. So, like, even if you were going to say there's something about seeing a couple extra pitches or whatever, you think that would materialize most in the first inning. And his OPS is, like, more or less the same in the first inning, hitting second or third. And then it's only once you get to the later parts of the game. So I don't have a good explanation for it.
I don't either.
No.
I really don't.
If he feels better in it, roll with it. The one thing that, like, and John Schneider mentioned this after the game, is that the push-pull is if he's hitting second, you're going to see him up at the plate a little bit more. Like the example where Bo and Barger get out last night, the game ends with down one with Vladimir Guerrero Jr. In the on-deck circle. That's time. It works out to about, each spot you go down in the order, works out to about 17 extra plate appearances a season.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that would be there. If he likes hitting third better, if you like the way the lineup flows, is it worth losing one Vlad plate appearance every 10 games?
Yeah.
Right.
That's where the interesting part of it comes in, sliding them down. And that's not a lot.
That's pretty fascinating.
But one every 10 games is not nothing.
Yeah. And listen, John Schneider, after the game, did acknowledge that there is something to comfort level.
Yes.
Right?
And he said, there's something to it.
There's
he didn't seem to know
to
what
it.
Either.
Yeah.
But I feel like
I failed in that moment as a reporter. I did look for Vladdy after the game because I did want to ask him, what is this about? He was there for a second. I blinked. He was gone. I couldn't get him. But that is something that I'll try to, you know, if we see more of it, I will try to get an answer.
What a great night as a superstar. You have a big night. You've changed your spot in the batting order, but then two other guys are going to be asked for post game before you.
Well, yeah, he had 3 hits last night.
Yeah.
And then this moonshot here that I desperately tried to lean over and grab.
He's still standing in the batter's box watching
that. Right there.
Yeah, there you go.
Oh, that's so awesome.
I just, that swing right there, and we talked about it on Blue Jay Central a little bit, where I felt like at times he was getting a bit steep with his barrel angle to get to the ball, which you're thinking, okay, maybe I need to get underneath the baseball, so you're trying to get there as quickly as possible, but he has so much rhythm and movement in his swing, and I mean that in the best possible way. When I was looking back at it, was a home run that he hit off of Garrett Crochet earlier this year.
Okay.
It was a fastball, a little bit more up in the zone, but I felt like he was getting on plane so quickly. And he is a guy to me that has more of a line drive type of swing.
Yeah.
And so when I was looking at the angle in which his barrel was getting to the baseball, it just seemed more steep than what we've seen from him in the past. And then yesterday for him to be able to just unload on that pitch, you're like, oh, I'm watching it from the side. I mean, every single angle, and it's just, I mean, just about perfect execution, timing, hands, extension. And that's where too, I think the steep angle can affect the extension afterwards, because where are your hands moving after you make contact? And if you think about it, the steeper the angle down, your hands are going to just continue to move this direction. Whereas if you're a little bit more on plane, you're going to be on plane with the baseball and stay on that bit of extension just a split second longer to be able to drive that ball 450 feet rather than 350 feet. So it makes a little bit of a difference. But then the swing that he had on that pitch that you know, was practically going to hit him on the inside
the
part of the plate.
Yeah.
And then he's able to tuck his hands in and still adjust. So those are the things that not everybody can do, but he can because he sees the pitches out of the hand and he can make those adjustments. But, and as a pitcher, you're thinking, where do I pitch this guy? Like, where do you throw him? But that's exactly what you want. I think same could be said for a lot of different players in the lineup over the past couple of weeks too. You want the pitcher to be like, oh no, not this hitter again. And and it felt like for a while it was the entire lineup. You're thinking, I don't want to face these guys, but that's exactly what you want from the offense.
I'm wondering if, and this is just something that occurred to me just now, but it seems like Vladdy has been attacked a little bit more in the inner part of the plate recently.
Especially with velocity.
Is that,
the numbers
is that
bear
fair
that
to
out.
Say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I guess, you know, if he has the quick hands, which helps.
Yeah. And that's where it sounds like you would almost be late. Well, you know, when I'm talking about flattening out your barrel a bit, you're thinking, oh, it's going to take you longer to get there. But I think when his barrel is turning really quickly back behind him, and that's where he's able to get his hand, like a little bit more space. Joe Siddle and I were talking about this before the game yesterday. When you're making contact with that inside pitch, but you still have a little bit of room to be able to get that extension, that's when you're going to hit the ball with power rather than coming at the sharp downward angle. And that's where you get those hard hit 106 miles an hour off of the bat,
so the
hard hit ground balls on the ground. But for him, he's again, swing path wise, he's not a player that's going to go up there and just drop barrel back behind him and try to get lift and try to get underneath the ball this way. Like, yes, you're going to see some of those swings every once in a while, but he hits line drives really hard. So how do you get back to that? And I do think that the timing on that swing on the fastball that he hit out yesterday, that was a product of everything being back in sync.
It's great. It's a lot going on there at the top of the order. And again, seven hits between the top three spots in the order. Right after we had talked about, you know, they're 14th in OPS from the top two spots, or 25th in OPS from the top three spots, or whatever it was.
Start making some ground.
Yeah. So that's nice to see. Also nice to see. So they won this 1-5-4, and the offense gets the headlines because of the, you know, back-to-backs to walk it off. But Madison, I know that you thought this game was, you know, up until that point, really kept where it was, kept winnable because of the efforts of Chris Bassitt against the number three offense in baseball.
Yeah, I thought he did a really, really good job yesterday, because when you were looking at a lot of different offensive categories for the Diamondbacks, whether it's home runs, OPS, they're, you know, like you mentioned, top three in baseball, but they also don't strike out a lot. So they're a team that's going to put the ball in play. So how can you induce weak contact and keep them in the yard? And I thought that Bassitt did a really, really nice job of that. And he was just mixing, and that's what he does. He's going to mix speeds. He's going to mix locations. But I thought his execution of the fastball at the top part of the zone opened up the bottom part of the zone. And I mentioned this yesterday, too. I feel like the Diamondbacks as a whole, their swings want pitches down in the zone. They want to be able to get that extension on the lower half of the zone to be able to drive the ball out of the ballpark. So how do you counteract that? Well, you try to jam them up on fastballs at the top part of the zone, see if you can get them to swing and chase, and then you get them out in front on those breaking balls that are down in the dirt. And I thought for the most part, he really did a nice job of executing that. He ended up a couple of hit batters, I believe both of them to Eugenio Suarez, and trying to work that pitch on the inner half that just got away from him. But for the most part, I thought he did a really nice job of giving the team a chance, because against that type of offense, they can be very explosive very quickly. So to keep your offense in the game long enough to be able to give them a chance to be able to come back in the ninth inning, I think a lot of that is the product of the job that Chris Bassitt did on the mound.
Yeah, 75% fastballs in that one from him, too, across his three different fastball types. Obviously, that was a lefty-heavy order. I believe seven of the starters were left-handed hitters or switch hitters hitting from the left side. Chris, a funny thing after the game where Chris Bassitt got asked about his cutter usage, because according to the pitch tracking, he threw 33 cutters, and he's like, no, I didn't. To him, those were a lot of those were four seamers that just got classified differently.
See, now I feel like I need to erase my scorebook, because I kept writing down cutters because that's what they were being classified as. So he ended up with his first, I've got right here, his first three strikeouts of the five strikeouts he had were all on the cutter, but maybe I need to switch that to four seam fastball. So
well,
but either way, they were, you know, fastball.
Pre-game today, we'll go through them. We'll look at each one. Like, hey, Chris, can you look at this video? Is this a cutter or a four seamer? Because some of those were like 86 miles an hour. I'm pretty sure those are cutters. Yeah. But some of the ones that were up in the 90s, I guess he thought were forcing. Anyway, it was a very funny, like, Chris Bassett.
But I think that can play to his game plan, too, a little bit. As a batter, if you're not sure which pitch is coming, if it's going to be the four-seam or if it's going to be the cutter, like, it's a completely different swing to hit some of those pitches. So he can use that to his advantage. Plus, the change in speeds, too. It almost acts as a couple of different pitches. So, and he was able to execute them in the spots that he wanted to for the most part. So I think that makes a big difference.
And what a boost that is for this rotation that just got another piece of bad news yesterday with Ben Francis hitting the IL. I think it's kind of a statement too, right? The Blue Jays are again asking a lot out of these three veteran starters. And Chris Bassett he's ready for it. He's ready to give you length and he's ready to keep in the ball game. Maybe he was even, I only caught a little bit of his post-game interview yesterday. I was in the clubhouse talking to someone else. Maybe this is a bit of a boost for him, too, to kind of understand that now more than ever this season, the Blue Jays need him to do what he does best, which is just pitch to length.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like, this is a guy who beats himself up if he only goes five and two-thirds, right? Yeah. He's usually on his
even
own
case.
Even
during the game yesterday, there was one pitch that he did not execute to the spot that he wanted to, and very quickly, you know, okay, he did not execute that one. He's very animated out there on the mound, but it, to me, it shows the competitiveness and the high standards that he has for every single pitch that he throws, and he knows that one pitch in a sequence can affect the rest of the pitches in the at-bat. Mm-hmm. So that's why he is so on every single pitch and spin and location, because it can really affect the rest of the at-bat. But I thought he had great movement on his pitches, too. But to be able to shut down that type of offense the way that he did speaks volumes to the job that he did.
You mentioned weak contact as well. Obviously, early in the year, his strikeout rate was up. It's now kind of back where it normally is, but he is 90th percentile in average exit velocity, and over the last four starts, it's been like some of the weakest contact in all of baseball. Like, we're talking like 82, 83 miles an hour off the bat on average, which is soft.
That's, you're
unless you're Miles Michaelis the other week, those aren't dropping in for seven or eight hits in a game.
Well, your defense is loving it too, because they're able to make plays on those ones. And I think too, because I always try to think of things from the offensive perspective and game planning against somebody like Chris Bassett, and it would be really hard because he throws a variety of different speeds in different locations. And so you're thinking, okay, if you want to sit on a certain pitch, well, he's going to throw it all over the zone. So you almost have to take it a couple of steps further than just say, you know, looking for the sinker or looking for the four seam cutter, you know, whatever it might be, because he's able to locate it all over the zone. So that's another reason why he does get the lack of contact, I should say, that he does, because it's hard to decide what you want to swing at when you're facing somebody like him. Plus, I think his delivery itself can be a bit deceptive with the way that, you know, his left arm, his glove arm will come flying open, and then his throwing arm comes around. So all of that kind of works in his favor to get a lot of those miss hits.
It's also interesting, too. Like, right now, he has talked about how he's, you know, looking for some stuff, and, like, mechanically, he's moved one side of the base to the other side of the base. So even if you're watching video on him, I'd imagine it's not that indicative of what you're going to face, because he keeps tinkering.
What are we going to see today? You don't know. And maybe and that could be a product, too, where as the game goes on, you're trying to adjust to what he's throwing, but he's already thinking about 10 pitches ahead of the one that he's throwing right now. So again, that goes into how do you game plan against him? And I do think that you see hitters just get into a spot where they're trying to react to what they're seeing, which doesn't always lend to taking chances like we saw from Bo Bichette and Addison Barger. So you might not hit the ball as hard. And there was, I want to say there was one that maybe blooped in yesterday that ended up driving in a run. Was it Alec Thomas maybe that blooped one into center field that ended up driving in a run? But those things are going to happen. You're going to give up hits. But for him to prevent the long ball and keep the ball in the yard, that was big for the team.
I forget which opposing manager said at one point, maybe it was a couple of years ago, you know, asked basically how do you game plan for a guy like Chris Bassett who has the surprise factor working for him and can throw really anything at any count. And what he said was, well, you kind of just try to eliminate a quadrant of the zone and then focus on, but there are perils to that too, I would imagine, right?
And if he has a game plan of saying working to a different quadrant than what you're looking for, it's going to be a tough night. And that's where when I was looking at how to game plan against the Diamondbacks, and if I were Chris Bassett, what would I be throwing? And I looked back through at some of his other games that he's thrown recently. There might be a game where he's locating his pitches a lot more in the low part of the zone. And then you look at another game and he's throwing a different pitch mix. His arsenal is completely different. The percentages are completely different, and he's locating his pitches more the top part of the zone. And I do think that plays into the effectiveness that he has out there and the lack of game planning or that you're able to do against him, because you're sitting here going, where is he going to attack us today?
Yeah.
And yesterday and now he has to be able to execute his pitches too. And you saw that yesterday, him being able to hit his spots. But yeah, it's fun because you never know what you're going to get when he's out there. And I mean that in the best possible way. But it's always exciting to see how he's going to decide to go after certain batters, because he does have so many different pitches in his arsenal.
Is your sister a catcher?
She is a catcher.
Nice.
Yes.
Do you guys ever talk about, break down that sort of stuff?
Yeah, we talk a bit about just like kind of game planning in the sense of what she's looking for. And I think both of us are pretty similar in reading swings and tendencies. And one of my things too is I never took swings in between pitches. I never took swings on deck because I always felt that the opposing team or opposing pitch caller was watching what I was doing. Because how many times do you see batters working on what they're trying to execute in the batter's box? So I felt like that was going to give away my game plan a little bit. So it's those little things that maybe might not mean much, but we can kind of sit there and game plan and talk about those things. And it's a lot of fun to hear from the catcher's perspective of things.
That's fun. We will talk about your sister, Allie Shipman-Trout, a little bit in the second segment. Yeah. We'll talk some AUSL. We'll talk some Women's College World Series. Last note for me on the game. The Blue Jays used four different center fielders yesterday. It is the first time since 1985 that they've had to use four players at any one position in a game, and the first time they've ever done it in center field. Jonathan Clase is expected to be fine. He got hit on the right knee with a pitch and came out of the game. Miles Straw, they sounded less sure that he will be fine, said they don't think it's going to be a long-term thing. He kind of caught his ankle when he ran into the wall trying to make a play on a Josh Naylor ball. And Josh Naylor, what a guy, runs out to center field to check on him.
Yeah, what a great moment.
Have you ever seen that before?
No, Jamie and I were sitting up there in the studio set thinking, I can't remember the last time that we've seen that, but I thought that was awesome.
Yeah, Josh Naylor said he's like a brother to me. This is Mitch Bannon, our pal at The Athletic, had some quotes from Josh Naylor and Miles Straw about that moment. I'm like, yeah, if that was my brother, I'd go out there and make fun of him, not help him, make sure he's okay first. Kick a little dirt on him. If there is a corresponding move, it was RJ Schreck pulled from a AAA Buffalo game yesterday. We'll keep an eye on that. Might talk about him on Blue Jay Central with you guys yesterday if he is getting the call, because he's a pretty interesting guy. And Joey Loperfido picked over once again. We'll keep an eye on that. Right now, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll talk some Women's College World Series. We'll talk some AUSL. Talk about your sister a little bit and the women's pro game. That's next as Madison Shipman stays with us and Jay's Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Big opinions and in-depth conversations covering the Leafs, Jays, Raptors, and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome back to Jay's Talk Plus. There we are. Mentioned what was going on with the Buffalo Bisons, the AAA affiliate of the Toronto Blue Jays last night, with RJ Schreck coming out of a game down on the farm for the Arizona Diamondbacks. Their AAA team was also walked off by a home run in the ninth inning. Rodolfo Duran taking the Reno Aces deep for a three-run shot. I don't know. Someone texted that to me. I thought it was interesting that all the teams in the org got walked off yesterday. Madison Shipman is still with us, by the way, for this segment here. We're going to talk a little women's softball. So, Madison, you are rejoining us. You rejoined us for the Philly series for Blue Jay Central. You will be with us for Blue Jay Central and some radio calls throughout the remainder of the season. We don't get the full Madison Shipman on Blue Jays until the Women's College World Series ends. I know it was a week or two ago now, but how was it?
Oh, unbelievable. The games were outstanding. It seemed like every game there was something that I hadn't seen before in a game. Everybody that works the event, to camera crews, everybody that's involved. It's an outstanding event. But there was one pitcher for Oregon. Her name's Lindsey Grine. She goes to throw the pitch, and a piece of dirt that was on her cleat ends up floating up, and her pitch ends up, we ended up calling it the dirt ball the entire time, but it was an unbelievable, just one of those things that's probably just never going to happen again.
Yeah.
It was insane. There were walk-off home runs. There were one batter hit a home run and missed the plate. They went to review and came back and said that she missed the plate, but they couldn't review the play. There was a whole there was so much that was involved. The games were so close and so intense, and it was just, you were on the edge of your seat the entire time. It was so much fun to be a part of, and congratulations to the Texas Longhorns for coming away with the national championship.
Does that one hurt you a little to say the congrats to the Texas Longhorns? I noticed, by the way, so you did the regionals, the super regionals, and the yes. World Series. They didn't have you where Tennessee was until the final bracket.
Yeah, I was, last year I was in Knoxville for regionals and for super regionals. This year I was in Austin for regionals. I was in Norman for super regionals, and then I was in Oklahoma City for the World Series. But it was so much fun. Well, and Carlin Pickens, who pitches for Tennessee, threw the fastest pitch on record, 79 miles per hour, throws absolute gas. I'm not sure what the baseball pitch equivalent is to that, but 79 miles per hour for a softball is coming in real hot. Yeah. Nice. The fastest pitch that I faced, probably 74, 75.
Right.
So 79, that is coming in there really fast. But no, it was awesome. It was awesome to be a part of, and it's one of my favorite events all year because the fans were in it the entire time too, and some of the people that I get to work with too. Danielle Laurie, who played for the Canadian national team, won a bronze medal. Get to work with her all week long, and Amanda Scarborough, Courtney Lyle, just so many great people that I'm able to work with for that entire series.
Tell her to have her brother hit us up and come on the show. We'll talk pre-workout routines and stuff like that.
Toronto fans know the Laurie family.
Yeah.
So, you know, as you talk about all of the different points of excitement and new things that are happening, you know, really, you know, players breaking some barriers and finding new gears and all of that. Can you still learn something new about the game, you know, from a new perspective, I guess, that you have right now?
Yeah, I feel like, well, one, the statistics and the analytics in the softball world are continuing to grow and become more of a factor when it comes to coaches and game plannings and all of that. I do feel like back when I played, you typically had, you know, one or two pitchers that would roll out there and throw complete games. And you know, I always joke with Danielle, one season she ended up throwing 352 innings. But that's just the way that things were. You just went out there and you just rolled with the same pitcher and you just threw and threw and threw. And now a lot of teams have taken more of a bullpen approach where you might have an opener, you might have a middle reliever, some teams have a closer that comes in. So you're seeing the game evolve and adapt and the hitters adjusting to the way that the hitters are prepping. And now there's machines where you can just plug in exactly what you're going to see, and you can see those pitches coming out. And that has changed drastically even over the past couple of years. So I even joke with my sister too that film when I was playing, when we were watching, it was, you know, you're watching the DVD, the recording film, and you're literally like pressing fast forward, rewind, pause. Like that was our film. And now right after the game, you can look through and you get all the cut-ups and you get what pitch it was, velocity, tendencies, like everything. So the game is continuing to evolve as the technology continues to grow.
The game's also continuing to evolve, it seems, in terms of the interest level and the momentum
the
and things like that.
Awesome.
We've talked a couple times about the AUSL and Major League Baseball's investment in that and how excited everyone seems for that. Do you feel that you've covered a number of College World Series now? You, of course, played in one and went to the final in 2013.
We lost. It's okay. It's fine.
I said, that's why I worded it played in the final.
Yeah, in the final. Yes.
Yeah. So if you look at the last, you know, decade to decade plus, can you feel that in the role covering the women's game?
Yeah, I when I looked at the World Series, and I've said this for years in the past, when you want to see a physical representation of the growth of softball, then you look at the stadium that they play in Oklahoma City for the World Series, and it continues to grow and grow and grow. And this year, there's a little bit of a bittersweet feeling when it comes to the championship series, because it feels like the World Series is coming to an end. But this year, it almost felt like there was going to be a whole new beginning with the AUSL starting up. And so there's that level of excitement of a newness and an excitement around the sport and being able to see it grow and being able to hear about it firsthand from my sister who's been involved. It's really, really fun to hear how much just joy and passion and love there is for the sport and how it's continuing to grow. So I'm looking forward to following the games the rest of the year. If the weather would just cooperate just a little bit, unfortunately, the roof at the Rogers Center will not fit in my carry-on, so I can't take that around with me. But yeah, so there have been some weather delays that they've had to deal with, but it's all right. They'll play some softball soon.
So they're in Kansas now,
yes.
Then Louisiana, then Tennessee. How do you feel about the barnstorming element of this first year? It seems like a good way to, you know, attract more fans, but it's probably also a grind, right?
Yeah, you're trying to get exposure in different parts of the country, right? And I know that there's a lot of fans across the U.S. that want to be able to watch these games. And so I think it's really cool that they're able to travel to different parts of the country. Now, the professional league that I played in when I graduated college no longer exists, but we would kind of do the same thing. We would go around and we played in a lot of minor league ballparks, actually. And we would go and play in some of the baseball stadiums. And that was fun. Learning to field on grass with the mound in the middle there. I remember the first ground ball that I took, it was a slapper that hit kind of a chopper at short, and I went to field it and ended up running up the mound to try to throw back to first base, and I did not take into account how much higher I was, and I just sailed it. Just absolutely sailed it. So that was an adjustment for me. But I do think it's really great that fans in different parts of the country are able to experience just how unbelievably talented these softball players are, and the work that they put in to be able to go out there and perform at the level they do. It's great softball. It's so much fun to watch.
And you're familiar with a lot of
yeah, the players. Yeah. There are a lot of players that I played against or played with, or players that I've called throughout their college careers. So it's a lot of players that I've been able to follow through their careers. And it was kind of it was a really fun full circle moment for we actually ended up having the game on while I was working Blue Jay Central this past weekend. And my sister came up. She got her first professional career start back behind the plate. And she came up to bat with runners in scoring position. And she was facing Kehlani Ricketts, who she pitched for Oklahoma when we lost to Oklahoma in the national championship game. But I also got a chance to play with Kehlani professionally. And so her first career professional hit came off of Kehlani Ricketts, who is somebody that I played against and played with. So it was a really fun full circle moment to see that happen. If you heard loud screaming from the studio set, that was me cheering for my sister.
That's so cute.
I do want to note, by the way, that while you were being self-deprecating about the losing in the finals,
we did win
a championship in the National Pro Fast Pitch League.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah, we did. Yeah, and Danielle Lurie was pitching on that team too.
Nice.
But yeah, so we did win professionally, but that loss in 2013 still stings, especially around World Series time, because that video of Oklahoma winning seems to pop up.
Oh God, does it haunt you? Oh
yeah, boy. A bit. Yeah, because we had the lead late in the game. It was extra innings. We had the lead late, and then Oklahoma came storming back. So
go ahead.
Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask, and maybe this is an insensitive question.
It's okay.
But I was going to ask how you remember that run. You know, what are the feelings that
2013?
It awakens? Yeah.
I am very competitive, and I want to win at all costs, but even though we lost that game, that was probably one of the most fun games that I have ever been a part of. It was just so well played on both sides. And Ellen Renfro, who was in the circle for us, she pitched outstanding against a team that had such a great offense, from Kehlani Ricketts to Lauren Chamberlain, Shelby Penley, just so many different players, Brittany Williams, Jessica Schultz. Like, I could go on and like name the entire lineup, because they were just so stacked. And the defense was awesome in that game too. And to have it just be nothing until the 11th inning, and then all of a sudden all these runs are being scored, it was a lot of fun to be a part of. Now I can still remember the home run flying over my head out into left field when Lauren Chamberlain won it on a walk-off. But that game itself was just one of the most fun games I've ever been a part of. So much fun. I wish we won.
You're smiling very brightly as you remember this.
Yeah, I still wish we won.
Oh, man.
Your sister is playing in the AUSL. Go Talons.
Yeah.
Does any of this give you the itch at all still, or have you kind of put that behind you now?
No, the cleats have been hung up a long time ago. The one thing I wish we did get an opportunity to do, and I was talking to Julie about this yesterday, my sister and I never got a chance to play together. So that would have been a lot of fun, but no, the cleats, you don't want to see me try to try to swing or try to run right now. You would have to like cart me off of the field right now. So we'll just talk about it in the booth. That's fine.
I guess we'll have to just live with the highlights from the 2013.
I don't believe you that you couldn't still do it. Like I feel like you could, but
we played a wiffle ball game in Oklahoma City when we were there for the World Series, and I'm pretty sure I'm still sore from that because okay. I don't know how to not go 100%. So that is my own personal problem. And even though if I haven't stretched or haven't played for years, I'm still going to go out there and try to, you know, play the best shortstop that I possibly can, even in a wiffle ball game. And I would say I went 0-for in that game. I probably should have made some better swing adjustments. I made an error over at shortstop. You see, I'm still stewing over the wiffle ball game. So there's my line.
Real reason why you don't get the itch, because you don't want this stuff to come back and consume you.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
And for our selfish purposes, we very much enjoy having you on Blue Jay Central and on
the radio call.
Well, so
thank you.
We would cheer for you, and we turn on the talons and cheer for whatever team you were a part of, but we're very glad to have you here instead. Very glad to have you on this morning. Madison, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Madison Shipman of Sportsnet. She'll be on Blue Jay Central for the rest of the series. Weekend Series 2?
Yep, Weekend Series 2. Nice. Yep.
Those amazing White Sox. Yes. Get ready to learn Shane Smith and Davis Martin and all sorts of guys that you haven't heard the name of yet this year. I'll join you guys on Blue Jay Central a little later tonight. Madison, thanks for doing this.
Yeah, not a problem.
We're going to take a break. When we come back on the other side, we got Mike Petriello coming on. We'll talk a little Addison Barger, talk a little Rafael Devers' adjustment to San Francisco. He made his debut last night. Clinton Yates is going to join us. We'll talk about the men's side of the College World Series. Fun one for Louisville last night, and then the semifinals get going today. All that's next in the next hour as JStock Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Teeing up the biggest games of the night, it's the Fan Pregame with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert.
Weekdays at 6 p.m. on Sportsnet, Sportsnet 590 The Fan, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jay's Talk Plus. Blake Murphy, Julia Kreutz with you. Mike Petriello will join us in a minute here. We got a couple updates that we can get to in the interim, though. I didn't want to make Madison sit here while I read out my notes.
That's nice of you.
Max Scherzer starting tonight for the Buffalo Bisons. He will go head-to-head with Tanner Houck, who is also on rehab for the Woo Sox.
What do you know?
Max Scherzer is aiming to get to 70 to 75 pitches. If he does that and everything feels good, he's probably back. It sounded like from yesterday's pregame comments from John Schneider. So we'll see how that one goes. We'll have it up on a screen at the Blue Jays game, of course. Elsewhere, Nick Sandlin appeared in his fifth rehab appearance, his third for AAA Buffalo yesterday. It did not go well.
Oh,
he faced four batters, two hits, two walks, but most importantly, he got through 18 pitches. I think with him, as with everyone, it's more about getting the pitch count up and seeing how you respond and stuff like that. I don't think he's coming back imminently. They've said they want to see him in back-to-back days before. And then even if he were imminent, you probably want to record an out before you come back up. Ryan Burr made his first rehab appearance yesterday since suffering his setback. Yeah. A couple weeks back, he pitched an inning for single-A Dunedin. A lot of walk, struck a guy out, 14 pitches in that one. And Jimmy Garcia threw a bullpen on Monday and will face live hitters on Thursday for the first time as he ramps back up. So that is the imminent pitching, the more imminent pitching stuff. Less imminent, Alek Manoah threw a second live bullpen yesterday. He threw 21 pitches and got up to 94 miles an hour. The plan is for him to continue upping the volume in those live BPs, not in rehab action just yet. Of course, you don't want to start the clock on the rehab timeline until you're ready.
Right.
On the position player side, Jonathan Clase sounded like he'll be okay. Miles Straw, we'll see today. It seems like RJ Schreck getting pulled from a AAA game right after the Blue Jays lose two center fielders.
Something to look out for.
Is related.
Yeah.
Nathan Lucas is set to begin a rehab assignment with AAA Buffalo today. Now, he's coming back from a concussion, so the length on the IL has not been that long, so maybe you could just bring him back, but also you want to make sure he's in a good spot. So there's a little bit of awkwardness there, but maybe Lucas only needs a game or two. So that's where it gets really interesting with Schreck not being on the 40-man of if it's going to be a short call up, why wouldn't you just do Joey Loperfido, right, who's already on the 40-man and who has been skipped by Alan Roden and Addison Barger and Will Robertson, and he's not even playing poorly.
Right on, yeah. I don't know. He's been playing well. I mean, he should get another chance at some point this season, in my opinion.
Yeah, I would have thought he would have got one over the guys who weren't on the 40-man. Right. By the way, Dalton Varsho is ramping up. He's going to try to run the bases Thursday or Friday, and then a rehab assignment would follow once he's clear of that. Anthony Santander still throwing, not swinging. I believe that's it for our injury updates for today. So let's get to the main event here. Let's talk to Mike Petriello of Major League Baseball and MLB.com. He joins us now. Mike, what's up, man? How you doing?
Hey, guys. I hope you enjoy my very exciting whiteboard right behind me. So it's great. I should have written something.
Yeah, you should have written like a little smack talk or something like that in the corner that only real heads would be able to squint in and understand, or something like that. Why are we in a whiteboard room, not the spaceship today?
Well, because the spaceship is what is like the actual studio.
Oh, right. That's the New Jersey one?
No, that's here in the main office. I have not booked it for this.
Ah.
Right. Damn. Yeah. There's so many conference rooms and things of the sort in that
I get
office.
It. Jamie Campbell, you can get up for the spaceship studio for. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz, you can't be bothered.
Yeah. Jamie makes me get dressed up, too. So it's a lot more work.
Yeah, not going to make you do that. You could have come in a band shirt. I don't care.
Yeah, we're just happy to have you, man. Thank you for joining.
all right, let's talk baseball. Mike, last night we saw Rafael Devers debut for the Giants. It was a funny day with some pomp and circumstance. He comes out with the like WWE style walkway with the smoke shooting up and everything like that. He makes the funny comments about, I'll play any position. They're the bosses. And then we also get to see him hit at Oracle. And you wrote a piece for MLB.com yesterday about what we can kind of expect there. Before we get into the specifics of that, take us through your reaction to the Rafael. We were texted a little bit about it, but man, trying to put this Rafael Devers trade and the timing of it in context here.
Well, you skipped the part two where the Red Sox got two hits last night and got shut out also. So there's that. Yeah, it's pretty rare. I mean, you don't expect to see trades in the middle of June, right? So that's one thing. But it's pretty rare where I get a notice on my phone about a piece of baseball news, and I'm like, I'm sorry, what? Is this real? I have to drop what I'm doing and go find out about this. And that's kind of what happened the other night, because I think everybody knew that this probably was not going to be a long-term marriage in Boston, but I was stunned by the timing of it all. Like, this is the trade you're doing, and you're doing it right now. And the more I've thought about it, the only thing I can come up with is that the Red Sox were so shocked that a team was actually willing to take on the entire contract and give some players too, that they were like, we should probably just go ahead and do this now. Now, whether that was the right move for the organization, obviously we can talk about that separately, but I just don't think they expected anybody would take it all. And I sort of landed on, I don't like it for either side. I don't like it for anybody involved, which might make me a negative person, I guess. But I hate it for the Red Sox, and I don't think I love it for the Giants either. That's where I'm at.
Is that partly because of, you know, the Oracle factor of it all, and the fact that, you know, the Giants haven't had a 30 home run hitter since Barry Bonds and things along those lines? And if you include stats for left-handed hitters, that becomes even more dire when you think about it. But we did see him, I guess, smoke an RBI double yesterday in his debut. Is that at least part of it for you?
Not necessarily. Like, they needed a guy who could hit the ball hard, right? Like, you go back and say they haven't had a 30 home run hitter since Bonds in 2004, and a lot of that's the ballpark. It's incredibly difficult to hit home runs there, but part of it's they just haven't employed those guys. Like, they don't have guys who hit the ball hard. You know, they had like Jock Peterson for a couple years, and Brandon Belt had his moments, and they just have not had these guys. And I don't know if that's like an organizational preference, or they just don't think that will play in the ballpark, but whatever it is, they just have not had guys who hit the ball hard. And he might be the guy who hits 30 home runs there. He's the best bet they've had in more than 20 years. But I've seen a lot of people saying, wow, it's going to be great. He's going to get out of Fenway Park. This is great for him. And they say that because right center in Fenway is pretty deep. But have you ever been to Oracle Park? Like, the triangle there, it's really deep. And the weather is often terrible. And he's not like a dead pull hitter type. He's an all fields kind of guy. He would pound balls off the monster in left field. He's not going to have that in Oracle. A lot of those doubles are going to turn into outs. So I don't think, you know, obviously they've added a very, very strong hitter, a very good hitter, and that's what they desperately needed. And so I think where you have to do is try to find this sweet spot between, man, he might be a DH or a below average first baseman, and I don't think that's the kind of guy I want to give a large contract to, and you shouldn't just count like the surplus value because you're trying to win baseball games, which is also pretty important. So will this contract look good at the end of the day? Probably not. Will he help them win games for the next 2 or 3 years? Probably. You know, it's a tough fit because he's not going to play third with Matt Chapman. He's probably not going to play first much. So I don't know how it's going to fit in the end.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. And you mentioned some of the park factors there. Oracle 26th in left-handed hitter park factors. Fenway's actually right up there in terms of helping left-handed hitters. And then Devers himself had big home run splits. I dropped a little thing on Buster Posey on the show yesterday that his average and OBP for his career were almost identical. His weighted runs created plus is exactly identical for his career home and road. And then he hit 97 road home runs to 61 homers. Home runs. There, yes. Yep. So Buster Posey, who engineered this trade, knows better than just about anyone the perils there. There's also an interesting thing. I went back and reread a 2015 piece from Eno Saris about how weird the batter's eye is at that ballpark as well. I don't think we could probably quantify this, but I would imagine given the way the sun sets over center field, they're like, there's going to be an adjustment period to hitting in a new ballpark full time too, probably. Right. So we maybe even if he's going to be really good, we'd probably expect a ramp up period here.
Probably true. I do remember that piece by Eno. It was really good, but they've also changed center field since then. Mm. So I remember we're all trying to figure out in 2021 how this team was any good and won 107 games. And, you know, part of it was like I joked on Blue Sky the other day, you know, everybody talks about no 30 home run hitters since Bonds, right? Well, in 2021, Brandon Belt had 29 in 97 mm-hmm. games, and it doesn't count because 29 is not 30. But he would have done it if he wasn't hurt so often. And they did make some changes to the ballpark. They had taken out this like video screen in center field that a lot of batters were complaining about. So I don't know how true it is anymore. I mean, it's mostly about the dimensions and the weather. But he's been through a lot over the last 6 months, and some of that's self-inflicted, obviously, just like the way his approach was. I don't think anybody said that he is obviously in the right with the way he acted in Boston. And now to get traded in the middle of the season, right after helping to sweep the Yankees with a home run, and now he's on the other side of the country all of a sudden. Like, it's a lot, and I'm very interested to see just the entire adjustment period will be. And oh, by the way, the Red Sox are coming this weekend,
yeah,
which is going to be so much fun. I can't wait.
It'll be a blast. This is a very pedantic question, but you mentioned Brandon Belt getting close, and 29 homers in 97 games doesn't count, even if he obviously would have hit one more if he got those extra 65 games. Devers is at 15 home runs right now. If he gets to 30, are you counting that as a third? No, I didn't think so.
No, absolutely. He did not. He's not. If he gets to 45, yeah, I'll count that. Yes. Yeah.
If he gets to 45, Craig Breslow is going to get tarred and feathered, I think. I don't think it's going to go well for him.
Yeah, my last question on Devers for you, Mike, was exactly that. Just, you know, as a numbers guy, what did you make of Breslow's comments about the possibility of the Red Sox winning more games without Rafael Devers?
I mean, anything is possible in the sense that, you know, there's never a 0% possibility. Like, maybe all the rookies come and start playing. Like, I don't know, Rafael Devers. Maybe the pitching looks great. It's not gonna happen. Like, the takeaway from this whole thing, right, is when Buster Posey got hired in San Francisco, there were so many people around baseball who you could just tell desperately wanted this to work, right? Because you got a former player, and not just that, a probably Hall of Fame former player for his own team. It's such an amazingly cool story if he goes in there and turns that team around. And a lot of it's, well, he's a former player. He's got feel, not like these number nerds that don't know the locker rooms. And meanwhile, how many years did Craig Breslow play in the major leagues? A lot. And so it's just, I think, a good reminder that whether it's a former player or a numbers guy, not everybody is going to be the same and fits into one box. Some people have feel,
yep,
and some people don't. And it's not always about whether you put on the spikes.
And some people have so little feel that allegedly, according to reports from our pal June Lee, they will just have an AI chatbot do their interviews for baseball ops people. We will leave that for today.
But, why? Man, Mike loves AI.
No,
we should talk about that.
Oh, yeah. No, he runs Grok. He's responsible for it.
No.
Yeah.
I'm gonna make one and send it the next time you text me asking for an interview, and we're gonna see how that goes.
Yeah. No, please don't do that. Please don't do that. So you mentioned the Red Sox only got two hits last night. The Blue Jays got two pretty big ones with one out in the ninth inning to walk things off. Mike, I know Addison Barger's been kind of a pet Statcast guy for you. You've posted about him a bunch. You and I have talked about him a bunch. The bat speed is significant, and you posted last night on Blue Sky. He's just gonna be a dude. That's good to know. So do I take that as you're in? You're buying on the Addison Barger we've seen this year?
I think so. When you think about the Blue Jays hitting roster of the last couple of years, right? I feel like I follow them closer than most Americans and most like national writers, but not nearly as much as you guys do, clearly. So tell me if you think this is wrong. But once you get beyond the big names, the Bos and the Vlads, there seems like there's just been like a never-ending run of 25-ish-year-old hitters who they hope will stick, right? It's Spencer Horowitz, or it's Nathan Lucas, or it's Alan Rodon, or it's Davis Schneider, or it's Will Wagner, and on and on and on. And Barger's been kind of one of those guys. And he was the one who I always was the most interested in because he swings the bat really fast. And ever since the bat tracking metrics came out in the second half of 2023, that's been a big thing is, hey, despite having Vlad Jr., the Blue Jays bats are really slow. And that's been true for 2 years. And bat speed is not everything. Obviously, Stephen Kwan is a very good player, but it's sort of hard to win if you don't have guys swinging the bat very fast and making loud contact. And so of all those guys, he was the one I was really most interested in breaking out because he's pretty much exactly Vlad Jr.'s bat speed, which is wild to me. And so the comparison you're referencing is I posted their metrics side by side last night, and you've got Barger and Vlad swinging about as hard, except you've got Vlad obviously with a pretty low attack angle and a pretty flat swing, whereas Barger is more geared for getting the ball in the air and making contact. And I think that kind of goes to why Vlad is obviously he's been a great player, like no doubt, but he's never quite been the consistent power threat everybody wants him to be because he's always hitting the ball, line drives, ground balls and all that. And yes, I did see him destroy baseball last night. But if you look at those profiles, like Barger is the one that's interesting to me because he is going to hit the ball hard and he's going to get it in the air. And he's made so many little weird stance changes. I think he had like a one game thing on May 4th or thereabouts where for one day he had a different stance. And if you go back to last year, he had a totally different stance. And if he's finally found the one that works, the raw material there is fantastic. So I'm not saying I think he's going to be better than Vlad, except there's like a tiny, tiny little part of me that wonders if for the rest of the season, he might be better than Vlad.
Yeah, it's interesting to sort of watch the evolution of Addison Barger because we saw him be really bad last year. And then he figured it out. He put all the tools together this year. And it is so enticing, right? You look at the numbers, you look at the way he swings the bat. There's so much potential there. Great. The potential started to materialize. But this is still, you know, relatively early in his career. And we're wondering, when a guy has a breakout moment like Barger did, what are you looking for when it comes to adjustments? Because pitchers are going to start to adjust. We've already seen that. And what are you looking for in terms of adjusting back for the hitter?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, the first thing I look at is, can you see anything under the hood, or is this likely to be some kind of, you know, good luck or whatever? When you're crushing home runs, that's not really good luck. But, you know, obviously the bat speed plays, the hard hit rate plays, and the adjustments in all the batting stance stuff has been really interesting. I can't really remember a guy who's made this many adjustments. Like, I don't know, Cody Bellinger might be one of those guys. And you can do that too much. Obviously, you can never get into a groove, but I do like that it shows a willingness to change, a willingness to say, okay, this isn't really working. Let me see if I can find out, you know, the way my body moves, what does work, right? And obviously, you're going to get different approaches with pitches. You mean, you know, breaking balls, pitches up in the zone, all that kind of stuff. There's never going to be a day where you have fully adjusted and there are no further adjustments to make. Like, that's just not the way the game works. But so far, so good. You know, you have seen him come into the league, as you said, and cut off to a slow start. And the simple fact is he's got enough other tools where he's going to get some run. Like, he's got an incredible throwing arm, as you guys have seen. There's an opening at third base, despite how much I like Ernie Clement. He's got the ability to play multiple positions. And these are all things that are going to give him, I think, a little bit more rope to try to figure it out, especially if he's going to keep showing this talent.
And so the Barger-Guerrero comparison is interesting for the bat speed reasons that you laid out, and then very different attack angles and things like that. They're also almost, the two of them and George Springer have almost identical OPS marks right now. Barger has 819, Vlad has 815, Springer has 818. So they're all very, very close. That is, and look, Guerrero had three hits yesterday. He hit one home run that was like 700 feet, but we don't get you on the show every day. So imagine yesterday didn't happen. Part of yesterday's conversation was the power had dried up a little bit. You know, the isolated slugging hasn't been there over the last 30 days or so. And 815 OPS is fine, but it's not quite the Vlad level that we come to expect. And it reminded me of in 2023, Mike, and because my answer to a lot of this has been, we'll get questions in the text line or whatever, what's going on under the hood with Vlad. A lot of the time it's, well, I don't know. He does this all the time. Like he'll have a month where he just doesn't hit that much for power. Now, Chris Black had a good thread yesterday about some of his issues with velocity on the inner third of the plate and an adjustment he maybe needs to make there to hit for more than just contact. But by and large, we've seen Guerrero Jr. do these ebbs and flows with the power hitting. And it reminded me of a piece that you didn't remember, but you in 2023, it got extreme enough that you wrote a piece about 11 possible theories about why Guerrero wasn't hitting for more power. We don't need to go into all of those, but when you see Guerrero have like a 3 or 4 week power outage now, is that just kind of in mind for you? And you're like, yeah, this is what he does. The power kind of ebbs and flows. Like, is there enough sample to just kind of lean on that at this point?
I mean, it certainly feels that way, right? Like, I think people leaned in a little too hard on going back to, oh, his great 2021 season doesn't count because it was in the minor league parks and all this kind of stuff. I'm like, it still counts.
Yeah, we can adjust for that stuff.
Yeah, exactly right. Did that help? Yeah, probably helped a little bit, right? But it's not just that. But I feel like we have been having, not you and me, just like the baseball we, this conversation about Vlad for about a half a decade now. You know, and we're never going to get to a point where it's like you want him to be exactly like his dad was. And I just don't think that's the kind of player he's going to be. Obviously not on defense, and he's just a bit of a different hitter on offense. So he's always going to have these underlying skills where you're like, wow, when he gets it, he looks like the single best hitter in baseball. And he's also going to go through these runs just because of the way his swing path is, where he's going to hit line drives or he's going to hit it on the ground. And he's obviously not going to be this enormous batting average guy, but, you know, you're not going to end up with these massive moonshots 3 times a week like you want. I've just sort of come to accept that this is what it is. I think it's going to probably not change at this point. I know he's young, but he's been around for, what, 7 seasons now? And I feel like that's just not going to be satisfying for a lot of people.
It's a tough one. It's also fascinating, by the way. Obviously, his father was a very different hitter. Their career weighted runs created plus are almost identical at this point, which is really really amusing.
That is pretty cool. We'll keep tracking that from now until the end of his career. Too.
Yes. So from one Canadian-born player in Vladimir Guerrero Jr. to another in Denzel Clark. Mike, look, the conversation is like 2 weeks old now about the catch probability on that one Denzel Clark catch.
Sure.
And I know you unfairly, I find it really amusing, but similar to the AI and Grok thing, unfairly, like, people come to you and they're like, I don't like this catch probability. With Denzel Clark in general, though, he is like kind of pushing, even with that one catch having a high catch probability or whatever, he is like really pushing the limit of what I thought a guy could rack up in terms of defensive runs saved or outs above average in limited innings. When you've been tracking this stuff for a long time. Just how extreme are we talking? The value Denzel Clark has provided the Athletics in the outfield in a small window here.
Yeah, I got a big kick out of that. Nobody liked the grade that that one great catch got, right? And I get it. I'm not entirely with everybody, but I'm on board. And yet, despite that, the Statcast metrics, which supposedly hate him, have him as the most elite, like, per play outfielder in baseball, which tells you a lot, I think, about how it captures what's happening and how great he is, right? He's absolutely fantastic. If you want to talk about what happens on wall balls real quick, I'll give you a quick backstory here. A couple of things can be true, right? Many home run robberies are just not as impressive as people want them to be, because some of them you can just get to the wall and stop and put your glove over the wall and you don't get extra credit for preventing what might have been a home run. Now, Clark's catches are not like that. I will give you that. I think part of it was the one particularly great catch of the several he's had came in what is essentially a minor league park, which I think is a little bit harder, you know, for the tracking cameras to know exactly where everything is. So you give it a little bit of credit on that. But at the end of the day, he's making catches that look phenomenal. And so the way I looked at this is he was like, I don't know, fourth in outs above average or thereabouts in amongst outfielders, where the top of the list is like Pete Crow Armstrong, who's fantastic, and Sedan Raffaello, who's fantastic, and all these guys. And he had like a third of the innings played, which is just obscene. And that's even without him getting the full credit that people want. And yet, I want to enjoy every minute of him in the outfield, because as of the other day, he had like a 54% strikeout rate. And I don't know that there is outfield play that can sustain a strikeout half of the time.
Yeah, he had a big series here, and we maybe thought that that was kind of, you know, him settling in a little bit more at the plate. It was a terrible first game for him. We were like, well, you know, and this is his the ballpark he grew up going to games at, and you know, and now he got that out of the way, and then he had a couple of good plate appearances at the rest of the way. Just did not carry it over. It's hard. I mean,
the strikeout rate's down to 47% at least. So maybe it's progress. Trending. But yeah, 34-1 strikeout to walk ratio is tough. Mike, before we let you go there, so Denzel Clark, obviously phenomenally defensively. You just named a couple of guys there: Pekka Armstrong, Seti Raffy, Dalton Varsho will be back at some point. When you look at the overall landscape in Major League Baseball at the center field position, you comfortable saying that like? Look, maybe the data isn't perfect for the 2010s or whatever, but it really does feel to me, and it looks like from some of these early season numbers, we're kind of in a golden age for center field defense right now. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, absolutely. And I get it. There's some people are going to hear that and go, well, nobody can be better than Willie Mays or, you know, Andre Jones or whatever. Like, there's obviously been great defenders, whatever. But I think if you look at just the landscape of baseball, and people like to talk about batting average dropping every year, right? And most of it's about strikeouts and nasty pitchers, and that's all true. But it's never, ever, ever, ever been harder to buy a hit into the outfield. So forget strikeouts. You've already made contact. You've done the hard part. You still can't get a hit in the outfield. And some of that's about positioning. Obviously, teams have got all the positioning data, and I think that's improved. But it's also about the fact that you don't really get a lot of 34-year-olds playing center field anymore. And I understand you saw Kevin Kiermaier doing that. Well, he might be the all-time greatest center fielder whoever played defensively, or at least in the conversation. And now you got all these guys who are like 24, and they're incredibly fast. And, you know, PCA is a bit of an outlier because he's hitting, so he might actually be in the MVP conversation. But most people don't know who Jacob Young is, right? I'm not going to tell anybody what team he plays for, because you're all going to have to go figure it out. He's an unbelievable outfielder. Can't really hit. Plays for a losing team. Nobody knows who he is. But you've got so many guys like that. Like last year, Mike Ciani was one of those guys. And I looked at the data last year, and it basically comes out to this. Center fielders in particular are getting younger, and they're getting faster. And that's what it is. And they are like hoovering up absolutely everything out there. And it's fun to watch if you love incredible defense. And if you actually really, really, really want batting average to come back, then you're probably going to have to draw a circle in the outfield and say, you guys got to stand here. And I don't think anybody really wants that.
Yeah, we kind of saw that yesterday. The Blue Jays had a ton of hard hit balls. The game actually could have gotten away from the D-backs a lot sooner. But it was just outfield defense, good positioning, yeah. All of those.
In
things.
Alec Thomas's case, weird route, but stick the landing, which happens sometimes too. Alan Roden had one of those the other day. Well, in the stick the landing parts, I don't know how outs above average grades when you leave eye black imprint on the wall, but should get bonus points for that too. And yeah, here's a hint on Jacob Young. The team he plays for has lost 10 in a row, and they keep finding more funnier and funnier ways to lose, including to the Colorado Rockies. Things not going well in Washington.
Yeah. Oh, you gave it away. People were supposed to look it up.
I know. No one who doesn't know who Jacob Young is was going to go look up who Jacob Young is. It's like the only people who know are Nationals fans and like disgruntled fantasy owners that he doesn't get on base enough to use the stolen base tool that he has. That's it. That's Jacob Young's. But yes, that was very dumb of me. Sorry to give it away. Anyway, okay.
It's all good.
I should let Mike go. Mike, you're a busy man. Thanks so much for taking the time. I really appreciate it, buddy.
Thanks a lot, guys. Take care.
Mike Petriello, MLB.com. A lot of terrific work over there. And yeah, if you have any complaints with StatCast or the general existence of AI, we're going to blame Mike for all that stuff.
Yeah, you should tweet at him or go to Blue Sky and do whatever you do at Blue Sky. This is
I still just call it tweet.
Yeah?
Yeah, I'm sure I'm not supposed to, but I don't know what else to
do. Do you know what? I respect
tweet as a verb is just like stuck in my head at this point. I don't know what else to do with it. What else we could do is take a break. On the other side, we're going to talk to Clinton Yates of ESPN, of Anscape, formerly of Around the Horn. Rest in peace. Clinton Yates will join us. We'll talk a little men's college World Series baseball. Very fun one with Louisville last night. Great chat with Clinton. We taped it yesterday, so we didn't know the Louisville result, but still a lot of good stuff around that tournament, around Louisville. And then we'll get you set for Diamondbacks Blue Jays tonight. Eric Lauer against E-Rod, Eduardo Rodriguez, down at Rogers Center, 7 o'clock start. All that's in the final segment as Jays Talk Plus continues with Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. Blake Murphy and Julia Kreutz with you. One small note. We talked about RJ Schreck getting removed from a Buffalo Bisons game yesterday and the potential that, hey, maybe that's a taxi squad move. Alternate explanation was sent to me as well. He has been hit by a pitch twice on the hands of late. So possibly related to that. He wasn't hit immediately before, but I guess earlier in that game. So I went back and watched, and it didn't seem like he didn't seem uncomfortable or whatever, but like obviously you can't tell with someone. Like, he did another at bat after that. So I don't know. It's possible that it's injury related and not taxi squad related. We'll see. We'll see today probably, because if Miles Straw is going to need more than a day or two, I would imagine they would make at least a taxi squad move.
But it may have been just a precautionary move there to make sure that he's okay. And it just so happened to perhaps happen at the same time that the Blue Jays had to use four center fielders in the same game.
Yes, and Schreck was playing center field. And
we'll keep an eye on it for sure. I think it's still worth it, regardless, right? If this was a precautionary move.
Well, and he's been on fire.
Right.
And like, the promotion from AA to AAA was probably overdue. He's he's almost 25. So even though he's only been at AAA for nine games, it wouldn't be, that would be a very quick promotion, but it's not as if he's 19, 20 years old or anything like that. The only curiosity about it is poor Joey Loperfido, but we'll see. We'll see how that one plays out. Right now, we're going to play an interview we recorded yesterday with Clinton Yates of ESPN and Anscape. He's been down at the College World Series over the last week or so down in Omaha. Really fun chat. And wouldn't you know it, one of the players and teams we talked about had a really fun day yesterday. Here's that pre-tape with Clinton Yates. I'm joined now by Clinton Yates. Clinton, let's start with the College World Series, man. Let's get right into it. You were down at the Chuck over the last week or so. How was the experience?
Well, there's a couple of things I got to explain about Omaha. Number one is that baseball for me is more than just the big leagues. And so every level of the game is something that not only I enjoy, but something that I cover. And I happen to think that not only college baseball, but the College World Series, men's College World Series in Omaha, it brings together this special blend of impact, pressure, and performance that you just kind of can't replicate in any other way. College kids who are playing baseball in the United States of America, they are in a specific situation where not all of them are going to go play pro ball. They're not all going to the big leagues either. And so they're at the highest level of what probably their careers are going to be. And so in general, the vibe and the competitive play is just something that I enjoy so much. You get a level of intimacy with the players. You see them walking through the hotel. You see the parents everywhere. If you really wanted to hang out with them, you could. It's just an unrepeatable, to use a baseball scouting term, situation that is really, it's really, really special.
So Clinton, you're there as media, you've got the scorebook out, you're in the media tent with all those snacks, but there was also one day you decided, now I'm going to go out and watch the games with the people. What made you want to do that? And how was that element of the weekend?
It happens occasionally, to be quite honest. Sometimes I get a little socially overloaded. And when you're in the press box with everybody, you're talking all the time. You're going game. You're going pitch to pitch, discussing everything. But I do want to add to that. That's another one of the reasons why I love Omaha so much, is that the kind of club and cadre of reporters and people who come together and go there every year, you kind of become friends. We like to call it baseball summer camp as a group, because there's people I only see in Omaha that I am legitimately real life, lifelong friends with, that I text year round, and we can't wait to get back every time. Opening weekend is perfect for that, because you get to see all eight teams play and nobody's been eliminated yet. And that's the magic of Omaha.
That's really cool. And it's particularly fun, I guess, Clinton, to hear you say that it turns into a bit of a community, right? And I guess it is also fitting that it is called the College World Series, because there is so much riding for some of these guys that, like you said, are not going to make it to the pros. At the same time, I'm wondering if you can kind of learn a little bit more about the next wave of talent that is about to hit the minor leagues by watching closely at an event like that.
Absolutely. I mean, that is essentially what I'm there to do. Those of you who know me know that I write about African-American athletes for the most part, and I try to highlight those young scholar athletes in terms of what they do. But to use a quick example, I don't know, let's just say Trey Morgan, who had a great tournament for LSU a couple years back. He's now in the Rays system. He's doing well. And even more specifically, Christian Moore, SEMO. Yeah. I saw him with my eyes hit for the cycle with Tennessee. They end up winning the whole thing. And then yesterday, literally in his hometown of New York City, he gets a triple and it's the game-winning run. Those kinds and scores a game-winning run in extra innings. Those kinds of things are fulfilling on a level that, you know, for me as a baseball fan, never mind a journalist, it's just really great to see that, yeah, you are going to get talent at the top level that's going to get to the next level, but that's not everybody, you know, and the pressure and the skill level, it all comes together, and sometimes you just get performances that are impossible to forget.
You mentioned that, you know, you tend to focus on African-American players and black athletes, and your piece on Louisville really stuck with me, especially for the throwback to Eddie King Jr. is a big part of that team. He was also famously a part of the 2014 Little League World Series team that had the controversy and all the kind of BS around it. How cool was it for you to kind of revisit that, tie that together with Corey Ray, who's now coaching in the Cubs system, and kind of paint the picture of Louisville baseball and what they've come to mean to the college baseball community?
You know, it's interesting because I learn a lot in all of these things. One of my favorite parts about covering sports is covering the journey as much as covering the results. And so when I learned that Eddie King was the youngest kid on the Jackie Robinson West team, I thought to myself, wow, I'll bet that really affected him as a baseball player. And when I talked to him, I even pressed it on him for a couple of questions. And he finally was like, dude, they took away all of the accolades after we had done everything, after we had had the experience at Williamsport, a place I've been to as well, which I highly recommend for the Little League World Series. He said, we got to meet the president. Like, who cares what happened after that? That was one of the greatest moments of my life. And now he's playing in the College World Series after the Little League World Series. And it really helped me sort of ground myself in what I understood about a lot of guys' journeys to where they get to in baseball. That could have been the kind of thing that if you're a young kid at the time, particularly a kid in inner city Chicago, and you get everything you've worked for taken away from you over something as stupid as boundaries, which again, we can get into a whole other discussion about why that matters or doesn't. And he just took it in stride and said, my guy, I got one of the greatest experiences of my life. Got to room with the Australians. And if you know anything about who they send to the Little League World Series, they're always one of the most well-supported teams and nations in that tournament. And he had nothing but good things to say about it. What happened structurally later was a different matter, but think about it. He's a 9-year-old kid. He's not worried about who's got the U.S. title from 2004 or whatever. You know what I mean? That's not even on his mind. He remembers meeting Barack and Michelle, going to the Oval Office, and getting his picture taken in his uniform with his buddies, who he still gets to play with on some level. It's really just amazing stuff.
And listen, I think there's also a lesson for us all there, right? As someone personally who struggles a little bit with validation sometimes, it really does put things in perspective a little bit, that it's like, yeah, listen, no one can take away your accomplishments. That is for real here. And especially when we're talking about this Louisville group, right now, I believe they're the final team standing that is not nationally ranked. And here they are playing good baseball. What is it that has stood out about that team for you?
Well, Louisville does what I like to say is my favorite part of the game. I'm a base running first guy when it comes to what baseball is. That's not just because of how I played growing up in high school, but it's because it's the most exciting part of the game. They put pressure on you on the bags. Sometimes Coach Mack does things that I don't particularly appreciate because they sometimes feel like foolish baseball. But it works out. It's a style of play that lends itself to exciting fan experiences. And they might not be ranked, but they certainly hosted a Super. And that Super was exciting. And so between their run they've had all through the postseason, I think it lends themselves well to what they're doing in Omaha. And that last game, I mean, that's exciting stuff. You get six in the eighth. I mean, what are we doing? You know what I'm saying? That's what we're there for. And I just really appreciate that people do it different ways. Another draw of what the Men's College World Series is it's not machines. They're not all programmed to do the exact same thing at any given moment. Different teams, different styles of play. It's all different levels of fun.
Yeah, another great example of that was Murray State, who made a kind of Cinderella run with like nobody who throws hard on their team. Now that came to an end at the hands of Gage Wood the other day. Man, I know you had tweeted that you stayed an extra day, and because of that, you got to see Gage Wood throw the first College World Series no-hitter in 65 years for Arkansas. 19 strikeouts, 119 pitches. Man, how cool was that to witness up close?
It's fantastic because of all the things I just mentioned, the pressure in that moment Everybody's rooting for that kid. I mean, I'm sure Murray State fans are upset about it, but at the same time, you get to be a part of something that's never happened before. When he hit that kid in the eighth inning, the loud groan that came from the press boxes, people were just like, oh, no, because that's a point in the game where, listen, you're a young kid. You're on the biggest stage there is in college baseball. It could have all fallen apart. And if it wasn't for that goofball beanball rule, which, by the by, needs to be changed immediately, there's no world in which getting hit by a ball in which the umpire determines that you didn't get out of the way enough should be a strike. That should just be a dead pitch as far as I'm concerned, because it totally changed the nature of that game. The kid went from on first base as a pinch hitter to in the dugout. And now Gage only has two more outs to go to get to the no-hitter after losing the perfecto. God bless him. But that rule is a poorly stated one. It's a poorly adjudicated one. And it almost ruined what was the greatest moment of the Men's College World Series so far.
It's funny to hear you say all that, Clinton, because the one thing that stuck with me, obviously, it was huge. It was historic. And, you know, we're not going to forget that moment. But one thing that really stood out to me was Gage Wood's interview right after the game, in which, you know, he's basically asked, how do you feel? This is amazing. And his response is, I shouldn't have hit the guy. That's all I got to say.
Yeah.
Listen.
And he looked mad.
He really did.
Yeah.
And maybe it's still adrenaline.
And I'd like to give some credit to Danny Wexelman. Danny's the homegirl. She does a great job, her and Chris Button on the other side, the day team and the night team. And she asked the right question.
Yeah.
You know, you had a historic moment. How do you feel? And he said, hold on, forget all of that. That last AP or last half frame was a problem for me. And I appreciate him for being honest and understanding the moment of it as much as anything.
Yeah, the one thing I will say, and maybe I'll push back a little bit here, Clinton, because, listen, in my mind, there's nothing wrong with celebrating that accomplishment in that moment, you know? I know that we tend to romanticize those comments a little bit, but for a guy who to achieve something like that, I don't know. I wish we would have seen just a little bit more celebration, if that makes sense.
Well, think about it this way. Number one, both of his parents were in the crowd. He gave his dad the baseball from the game, and somebody in the dugout gave his mom the scorecard. And the reason why I think it was so specifically on his mind is because if you go back and look at his pitch sequences, that pitch was the worst actual pitch he threw all day. Mm-hmm. It literally got away from him. And I think from a performance standpoint, when you're a pitcher who's that dialed in, you're cataloging every single throw you've made. And it was still on his mind, which is understandable. Now, here's the thing that happened, too. After that situation with the hit batsman happened, he struck out the next two guys, or the next guy, I believe, and he let out the biggest F yeah I've ever heard on the mound. And you could tell how into it he was. This wasn't about the bigger moment. Reminder, the Razorbacks were facing elimination. They have been on the level, you know, a lot. And for DVH, their head coach, I know a lot of those guys did not want to lose for him. He's one of the best coaches in the history of college baseball. So it's understandable to me. It was literally instantly after the game, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The adrenaline is probably still running so high in that
Absolutely.
Moment there. I'll accept it, Clint.
Okay. All right. Very well. Very well.
Clint, want to go off college just for a minute here before we let you go. You are Mr. Snag, Grab, Stab. Every time there's a great catch, you're, you know, polling the Twitter audience on how we classify it.
Yeah.
Luis Guillorme the other night has a bizarre one that is a bad route and, like, gets tripped up going back to get it and then makes a crazy catch. How do we classify those ones where it's only a great catch because you messed up in the first place?
So, first of all, those are oftentimes the most fun. And secondarily, those happen way more than people think. They don't watch enough baseball. They don't really realize that the part of the greatness of being an MLB athlete is that oftentimes you are allowed to make mistakes because your physical skills will let you correct them. But what I love about him is that he leans into it. Bro, he's got so many plays where I'm like, that was a lot. He could have done that in three less steps. And also, on top of that, he retweets every single thing about himself, which is really, really funny. So, like, you want to know what he did, just go to his Twitter feed because he's letting you know. And that was a great play in the context of he really, really made it work. But, yeah, you can't circle the route to that ball like that and then have your left fielder standing literally right in front of you when you fall on the ball. Probably could have been a better break from the outfielder, but ultimately another great highlight for the game.
Clinton, I should have asked you this one months ago, but did you see the Dalton Varsho one earlier this year where he tripped and did a roll and then caught the ball still?
I don't think – I mean, I remember that barely, but I don't think that I did. To be honest – I don't do snack, grab, or stab as much as I should these days anymore. I got the radio show going. I got a new son. There's a lot happening. But it is still very much my wheelhouse and something I enjoy very much about the game, which is, again, it ain't just homers and strikeouts to me. I like base running, and I like the leather. Absolutely. You know what I'm saying? Yeah.
And as you said, it's not just Major League Baseball. It's the College World Series. It's the Little League World Series. Like you said, you're a very busy man, so we should let you go here. Clinton, really appreciate you taking time out in a busy week.
No problem. Let's do it again soon, gang.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Clinton. Really appreciate it, man.
Yep.
Yep.
Yes, indeed.
That was great. Clinton Yates, really fun to talk to. And as it would turn out, so we talked a lot about that Louisville team and Eddie King Jr. in particular. Eddie King, after Louisville blew a lead last night, Eddie King Jr. hit a walk-off sack fly, a very great slide to score the winning one from Alex Alicia, who had made an error during the big rally that they needed to come back from. So very, very fun.
Nice redemption story right away. That's awesome.
Yes. And Eddie King Jr. with the sack fly that was deep enough to get it done. Today, Coastal Carolina faced Louisville in one semifinal, Arkansas against LSU in the other semifinal. We'll see if those require two games or one. I forget the exact specifics of the format. And then Saturday, Sunday, Monday for the best two out of three College World Series final.
There's still plenty of time to get into it, and those are fun games. Madison kind of laid it out on the women's side. Yeah. It's not different on the men's side. If you have the chance, it's a fun time.
Yeah, it's very cool. It's also MLB Draft Combine, which we talked a little bit about yesterday. I already did all the injury and minor league updates, right? I have it in my notes here. I think I did.
Sure did.
Yes.
Before we talked to Petriello.
Sweet. All right. I can figure out the last 5 minutes of the show.
We can figure it out.
No, I couldn't remember if I read them all or not, and I didn't want to read them again because there was so much. So the thing that we didn't talk about.
Yes.
We talked about Bowden Francis going to the IL briefly with a right shoulder impingement. There is no structural damage. John Schneider revealing that he had been dealing with it for his last 2-3 starts. We had heard that, you know, mechanical and posture stuff he was working through, not entirely unheard of for, I mean, look, it's middle of June. Mm-hmm. Probably every pitcher has some inflammation in the shoulder and the elbow. So Eric Lauer is now in the rotation properly. He's starting tonight. He can go 80 to 85 pitches if necessary. That bullpen day with Eric Lauer now being considered SP4. The bullpen day is Friday. Spencer Turnbull in bulk is a possibility there. They also brought Paxton Schultz back up for some length in Bowden Francis' spot. They also designated Eric Swanson for assignment, and the corresponding move there is Justin Brule getting recalled. He was a fun story a couple years ago, going from undrafted to the Dodgers bullpen. He's bounced around a little bit since then, had decent numbers at AAA. Kicked myself a little bit because I made the joke about, like, oh, Tommy Nance and Dylan Dade have been really good.
Yep.
And then it ended up being a different guy, a guy who didn't make the bit in Justin Brule. John Schneider saying of Eric Swanson, he's been through a lot the last couple years on and off the field. We all, John Schneider included, hold him in a very high regard as a person, but kind of happens in the game when things aren't going your way. And I think that kind of captures it. Eric Swanson obviously dealt with the family issues at spring training last year, started things a little slow, dealt with some injuries, had a nice close to last season once the Blue Jays were out of it. But then again, injuries delayed his start this year, never really got it going on his rehab assignment, never really found his footing at the major league level. I'm a little surprised, given that the next option up is a Justin Brule or Tommy Nance or Dylan Tate, that they didn't give him just a little bit longer to try to figure it out at the major league level. But they obviously saw something in the 5 1/3 innings with 9 earned runs that, was as concerning as that stat line says.
Yeah, the one thing that stood out to me really with Schneider's pregame interview yesterday was, you know, he kind of said this is a matter of circumstance. And the way that I see it is you have three actually fixed spots in your rotation right now. And Eric Lauer has been good pretty much with whatever the Blue Jays have asked of him. We don't know how long that is going to last. I point to Easton Lucas, right, who kind of came in and dominated and then hitters made adjustments and it just wasn't working anymore. Lauer has been great, and there are no real indicators that this is going to be any different, but you can't know because he hasn't done this consistently in the major leagues for a while. So what choice do you have now that Bowden Francis is also on the IL, but to maximize every single spot available to you in that bullpen? When the bullpen needs to cover innings and the Blue Jays are still playing in so many of these close games, that's kind of what I read into the matter of circumstance type of thing. And yeah, the Blue Jays quite simply could not afford, unfortunately, this time to give Eric Swanson more time to figure it out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's I think it's a fair read on it, and I think it's an accurate one. And yeah, if they had five guys in the rotation going and a bullpen that had a clear, you know, even seventh inning righty arm, because like, look, it's not, it is semi-related that Chad Green is struggling to where I'm not saying you had to choose one or the other, but when you look at the entire bullpen construction, the entire bullpen usage, yeah, having a couple of soft spots, and it's probably relevant that Chad Green makes about three times as much as Eric Swanson when you're talking about cutting bait on a thing. And Eric Swanson's numbers were worse than Chad Green, although Chad Green is just, you dig under the hood and it's just alarm bells all over the place, as we've talked about a little bit. So yeah, it's a tough one. I am fairly confident, similar to when Tim Mesa was designated for assignment last year, someone's going to grab Swanson. It's a team that has a little bit more room to be patient with him figuring it out. Swanson, a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, was a very, very good leverage reliever with a nasty splitter. He probably needs to get a tick of velocity back to the fastball at some point and find the feel for that splitter the way it was in 2023. But he was a very, very good eighth inning leverage guy not that long ago. Some team will take a chance on him. Tonight it's Eric Lauer getting a start. It's not his first start, but it's the first one we won't count as a bullpen day because he's now officially in the rotation. He'll go against Eduardo Rodriguez, who has a 6.27 ERA, but in two games since coming back off the IL has looked pretty good for the Diamondbacks, four earned over 11 and a third inning against pretty decent teams in Cincinnati and Seattle. Not the certainly not the Dodgers and the Yankees when it comes to offenses, but pretty solid nonetheless. I will be down on Blue Jay Central to help set that one up with Madison Shipman. Thanks to Madison for joining us. That was a lot of fun in studio. Thank you to Mike Petriello and Clinton Yates as well. Thanks to Amit Mon, Austin Mackey, and Jennifer Rolnick behind the glass. If you want more from me, tune in to Blue Jay Central. If you want more from you, check out BlueJays.com.
That's right.
Have a wonderful Wednesday, everyone.